From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in for Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And President Trump begins his first foreign trip as president today as he prepares to exit stage left for Saudi Arabia. Some members of Congress emerged from a closed-door briefing with Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who this week appointed former FBI Director Robert Mueller as special counsel in an investigation into any ties between the Trump campaign and Russian election interference or any attempt to cover up ties. The president has called that a witch hunt. California Republican Daryl Issa was asked if he agrees.
Well, I don't personally believe in witches. But look, the director's job is, in fact, to go where the facts lead. And he has a reputation. Now, all special prosecutors turn over a lot more rocks than anybody else in the executive branch wants.
The week began with reports that President Trump asked FBI Director James Comey, who he fired last week, to lay off an investigation of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who Trump had fired back in February. And it ends today with the shadow of a special counsel investigation hanging over the Trump administration. So let's bring in our political roundtable. Ashley Parker is a White House reporter for The Washington Post. Hi, Ashley.
Hey.
Hey, and Rick Klein, political director for ABC News. Rick, welcome back.
Hey, guys.
So, Rick, I want to start with you, and let's talk about this Comey firing. Trump first said he fired Comey because of that memo from Rod Rosenstein. Then he says he was planning to fire Comey all along. Yesterday, Rosenstein tells senators that he knew Comey was going to get fired before he wrote the memo to the president. So, Rosenstein back on Capitol Hill today talking with House members. Did we learn anything new there?
The contradictions are critical here. And what we've heard from Rod Rosenstein now is that when he wrote this memo, he didn't intend it to be a bill of particulars that would lead to a dismissal. It wasn't intended to be that. He stands by the arguments that he made, but he is making clear this was President Trump's call. And it's these contradictions that have emerged over the week plus since the Comey firing that have got so many people just perplexed by the circumstances and have forced the hand. It may be that President Trump's move to fire James Comey backfired because that led to Rod Rosenstein having to distance himself, and that led to this appointment of the special counsel.
Well, not only that, Rick, I'm going to jump in to say it also led to Comey revealing that, well, wait a second, I had these conversations where I was asked to lay off the investigation into Michael Flynn, who was accused of having ties. So it led to a whole bunch of things. Look, the stock market fell with the news of the appointment of this special counsel to investigate all things Russia. It was also in part because the Republican plan of tax reform now seems further off the radar, and, you know, investors don't like that. But here's what President Trump said about the firing yesterday.
Well, I respect the move, but the entire thing has been a witch hunt, and there is no collusion between certainly myself and my campaign, but I can always speak for myself and the Russians, zero. I think it divides the country.
Well, Ashley, people are pouncing on that distinction there. I can always speak for myself and the Russians. Is that the president distancing himself from his staffers?
It certainly felt that way. And in watching the press conference, it was something I noted and other people noted. On the one hand, the president is technically correct, right? He can only speak for his behavior and he doesn't necessarily know what every low-level staffer or associate is doing. On the other hand, this is someone who ran, especially Donald Trump, ran as a business executive, ran as a chief executive. And I think there might be a standard. And again, I don't know or think it's necessarily a legal standard. But, you know, you are the head of your campaign. You sort of are responsible for what people below you are doing. That's the point of being a chief executive or a candidate.
Yeah.
So, Rick, I mean, so here you have the president being defensive about this. But is there a way that this could actually be a reset for the administration, that now that there's this special counsel on board, the administration can say, look, let's just let Mueller take care of that and let's forget about this for a while, at least if we can, and try to get something on the agenda taken care of?
It gives them some breathing room, but careful what you wish for here. In the short term, there's no doubt that this allows members of Congress who are pushing an agenda, people in the White House, to say, this is not a question for us. Let's go to the special counsel. But this is going to be slow. This is going to be long. This is going to be unpredictable. Once it's in the hands of a special prosecutor, he's got 2 months just to figure out his staff. It's very easy to see this extending into 2018 and beyond. And I don't know that anyone can have a handle on where a special counsel goes. That's been the history of these, the well-documented history of special prosecutors. And ultimately, even if this moment gives them a bit of relief, this story has predicted and so evolved in so many unpredictable ways. All of these scandals have kind of morphed into each other. I don't know that there's going to be any rest for the very weary folks in the White House.
Well, but, you know, I have to say, you know, to Trump supporters, they don't what scandal? You know, we're seeing a supporters parade across the TV shows saying, show me evidence of collusion. And of course, you know, others are saying, well, that's what the investigation is about. But actually speak to that, because we're getting this drip, drip, drip nature. Now, friends of James Comey are coming out and saying how uncomfortable Comey was around Donald Trump with that weird kind of godfather kiss once in the White House. And, you know, there's more and more dripping out.
Well, let's keep in mind that this has ripple effects that we've already seen and that we can't predict. So, for instance, while Trump maintains there is, you know, no collusion between his campaign and the Russian government, and we don't know the answer to that, but that very may well be true, that in the process of that, if you believe Comey's accounts and Comey's memos, the president sort of told him to drop the investigation, which opens him up to other potential legal headaches like obstruction of justice. So maybe he didn't do anything wrong with the Russians, but he may have been out of his lane. And if he in fact did tell the FBI director, you know, to stop this investigation. And then the other thing, especially with someone like Donald Trump, is he is so deeply reactive. So even if there's no there, just the fact of this investigation and the drip, drip, drip may affect his moods and maybe something that prompts him to wake up and tweet a missive that gets him in even more trouble we can't quite now predict.
Rick, where is Mike Pence in all this?
Mike Pence is in a very awkward spot. And this is several times now where Mike Pence has spoken publicly about something where he appears to have been ill-informed or misinformed or simply out of the loop. And the latest incident involves what was disclosed about Flynn's ties to Turkey. And he spoke in March, the vice president did, saying that he had no knowledge of anything until at that time. Now we learn from the New York Times and elsewhere that, in fact, the transition team was told of Michael Flynn's ties to Turkey and the money that he gotten from the Turkish government. Michael Flynn if he was actually telling the transition team and no one told the vice president who was heading that transition team, that is problematic. Yeah. And you're starting to hear concerns from Pence folks inside the White House about the way that they are being treated.
Well, Elijah Cummings, the Democrat from Maryland, said today that if Pence didn't know about this, he was either not telling the truth or he was running a sloppy shop.
Well, can I just ask, do you think there's a direct line between Mike Flynn's work for the Turkish government? He's revealed that he's registered belatedly as an agent of a foreign government, paid thousands of dollars to represent Turkey, which is very angry about the U.S. aligning with the Kurds against ISIS. Can you draw a direct line from that to suddenly we have Erdogan in the Oval Office and we have Erdogan watching out a window as his thugs beat up protesters in Washington, D.C.? Can you draw a line back to Michael Flynn?
I don't know about a line, but I think the dots are out there to be connected. Flynn was in the White House for a couple of weeks only, but he was setting policy. He set policy during the transition, and there's no doubt those policies had a big impact on the kind of meetings that are set up and the alliances that begin to emerge as Donald Trump establish his own doctrine, his own policy.
That said, I would just sort of caution that Donald Trump has sort of an affinity for strong men, leaders,
or
and
strong
dictators.
Men.
to begin with. And so that might explain Erdogan. You know, of course, he had the Egyptian leader in the Oval Office, which was something that President Obama had sort of explicitly refused to do. He's invited a lot of people, had phone calls with a lot of people, met with a lot of people that human rights activists do take exception with. And I think that exists a bit outside of Michael Flynn.
Well, and now the president is on his way to Saudi Arabia, going to make stops in Israel and Europe as well. How's that, Rick? What are you looking for in this trip? Because the president might hope that this will quiet down while he's gone, but probably it won't.
Well, first of all, this is almost a tour of people and places that President Trump has offended at times. Mm. He's going to be in the Vatican. Remember what he said about the Pope? He's going to be in Israel. They've been very upset with what's happening on the pregame, even the advance gaffes that have happened before he arrives. And, of course, the Muslims in the Arab world, to meet with Muslim leaders and the guy that called for the Muslim ban, this is going to be awkward. At best, this would be a bold, audacious trip with huge goals that would not be able to be obtained. You can't just bring Middle East peace off of one trip. But this is not the best case scenario in any event. This is a White House that's in crisis right now, and you're going to have major events playing out on Capitol Hill and in newspapers multiple time zones away from the president.
Well, but remember what was discovered in the Reagan era, and books have written about this, that the truth is, though, he will be seen on television screens surrounded by world leaders with big rippling American flags behind him. The imagery, we understand, especially from Saudi Arabia, is going to be incredible. They're putting so much effort into this because there's so much more in favor of him than they were with Obama, who, you know, made a deal with Iran. So it's going to look good. Ashley?
Yeah, it could potentially look good. And, you know, in the lead up to this trip and talking with foreign policy experts, and they weren't trying to be snide or glib, but they did say that what a lot of the world is watching for is what they want to be is reassured that this is, you know, tweets aside, sort of erratic behavior aside, this is a normal American president, a normal American government. And so the bar is pretty low. If Donald Trump can clear that bar, the trip will be a success.
All right. Ashley Parker, White House reporter for The Washington Post, and Rick Klein with ABC News. Thanks to you both.
Yep. Hey, thank you.
It's here
thank
and now.
You.
World leaders are waiting to see if President Trump will make good on his campaign promise to pull out of the Paris Climate Accord. The issue is expected to come up next week when Trump is at the G7 summit in Italy. Back in 2015, the U.S. and nearly 200 other countries agreed to cut back on planet-warming greenhouse gas emissions. And as we await word on that from the White House, we want to revisit a story from last November when I met a Swiss family sailing the world to witness the effects of climate change firsthand.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm Peter.
Hi, Peter. Nice. Welcome on Pachamama, huh?
Thank you, yeah.
Okay.
Shall we?
Just, yeah.
Okay. I met up with Dario Scherver on his boat, the Pachamama, on a windy, frigid day at the Boston Harbor. He and his wife, Sabine, had just sailed down from the Arctic. They've taken their handsome but well-worn aluminum sloop more than 100,000 nautical miles around the globe. They say they've seen 100 countries, climbed the highest peak on every continent except Antarctica, and shared their story with thousands of schoolchildren along the way. Their boat is appropriately named. Pachamama is an Incan word that means Mother Earth.
It's 50 feet long, and the mast is about 68 feet high. And the draft we have is about 8.5 feet.
You've got solar panels that we're sitting right behind here. There's wind turbines on the back here, I assume generating power as well.
Yeah, so that's the great thing, you know. We produce now all our energy with the sun and the wind. So weather like today where we have no sun, we have enough from the wind generators. When it's calm and sunny, we have it from the solar panels. And that gives you really a feeling of independence. And you're much a happier person when you have solar panels and wind generators, because it's like when you grow your own salad in your backyard. This salad, you know, is filled with love. You know, it's much better on the table. And the same is with energy. When you produce your energy, do you have a relationship with it?
You've been on the seas for a long time, port to port, country to country, continent to continent. Why are you doing this?
I mean, in the first place, it was because my office was melting away. So as a,
what do you mean?
As a mountain guide in the Swiss Alps, you know, I saw the glaciers melting, some mountains falling apart because the permafrost is melting. And so I told my wife, let's do something. And we came up with the idea just to explore. And we came up with the idea, let's connect all climates. And so we thought, okay, why we try once a kind of a world record to go to the tallest mountain, the top of each continent, just sailing, cycling and climbing, so with nature's force and human power, climate friendly.
I want to talk to you about some of the journeys that you've been on. I understand you just came from the Northwest Passage, but before I do that, it's cold and windy out here. Let's go see some of the boat and meet your family.
Okay, great.
Dario and I leave the deck and duck underneath a zipper canopy that's keeping the cold out. Okay, we're going down the steps in to the boat. Oh my gosh, there's a whole crew down here.
Hello.
Hi.
So we have here Sabine, that's my wife.
Hi.
Hello.
With baby Mia. She became probably the youngest ever going through the Arctic to the Northwest Passage.
How old is she?
She's now just became 1 year old.
Oh, my gosh.
And then we have our firstborn.
Hello.
Hi.
Her name is Selena. And then we have Andre.
Hi.
He's 10. And then we have Noe, born in Australia. He's 7. And what's your name?
I'm Allegra, and I'm 5 old.
Allegra, where were you born?
In Singapore.
Where were you born? You can't talk.
In Switzerland.
Switzerland? How about you? Where were you born?
I was born in Chile.
Chile? Oh, hey, buddy. Where were you born?
Oh, I was born in Chile, Patagonia.
Ah, you got something in common there with your sister. That is crazy. What a fascinating family. So here we are in the hull of your sailboat. This is your home.
So we are a family of 7 people, and with our friend Christina, we are 8. We have to provision sometimes for over 8 months. So last time before Boston, where we have seen a supermarket, was in Honolulu in May. So Sabine is really the expert, you know, of provisioning.
Now, you just made a big trip through the Northwest Passage. This is the sea route that normally is frozen over with ice. It connects the Pacific Ocean with the Atlantic Ocean. You just came through there. What'd you see?
Not much ice. But what we have seen in the Arctic was dramatic. Not only the wildlife struggling, like polar bears, they cannot hunt seals anymore because there's
that.
No ice. Yeah.
How did you see that if there's no
I
ice
mean,
there?
We have had once a polar bear 50 nautical miles offshore. You know, that's about 80 land miles, you know, offshore.
Floating looking, on an iceberg or something?
No,
or what?
Looking for ice,
swimming.
You know. Yeah,
really?
He was skinny, you know. They need ice to hunt seals. They cannot swim out the seals. So what they do is they are on the sea ice, waiting on an air hole till a seal shows up, and then they catch the seal. And so without ice, they have they cannot survive.
Can I ask the kids, did you see the polar bear? So tell me your name again.
Selena.
Selena, you saw the polar bear.
Well, Christina was having watch, and suddenly she's like, "Oh my God, there's a polar bear on the left side of the boat!" And we all just ran over there, and it was very cool.
So what happened?
I kind of felt bad for it, but I don't know. I don't think it knew that there would not be ice, but I hope it survived.
Sabine, what an experience for your children.
Yeah, I think that for me, that's it's a great experience to have the children with us all the time and go in different places and see different people, cultures, and wildlife. So I feel very blessed to see all that.
As difficult as it might be to see the polar bear struggling out there 80 miles offshore, we don't really know what's going to happen to that polar bear. Most kids don't get to see sort of nature that up close and personal, the sort of the brutality of nature too. But for you, is that's just that's part of the learning experience for your family?
Yeah, I think nature is the best teacher. We were really shocked, and we came up with ideas how we could save this polar bear, but we didn't have a good idea. But what we really wanted to say, we want to tell other people that it's really melting up there, and you know, we saw it with our own eyes, and the polar bear, they don't have a voice, but I hope people realize that it's really that we have to do something.
Dario, I wonder what you make of what's happening in the world right now, politically speaking. This is your life. You've dedicated all of your life to getting this message out, to observing it. But there are big questions about whether or not the Paris Climate Agreement, for instance, that was recently signed into effect, that's supposed to limit global warming to 2 degrees Celsius. There are questions about whether or not the United States will live up to its end of the bargain. In this country, climate change is not a driving factor that motivates a lot of people to the polls, for instance. We just saw this in our recent election. Do you feel like you're losing your battle?
No, actually, I became every year more optimistic about the future of our planet. I think the most important thing what we have to do to face climate change is, first of all, we have to build bridges. We have seen 100,000 students in more than 100 countries. And when you connect the students to schools, they became friends, they understand each other, they have a relationship, and then you can solve problems.
And what a life it must be to see all this, to spend a childhood at sea. No way, the 7-year-old told me about that.
It's pretty cool, and most of the time when it's not cold weather, like today, I climb up the mast, but today it's too cold.
And too windy.
Yeah, so now I'm in my sleeping bag.
So you go all over the world in this thing. What's it like when there's a really big storm?
It's actually really fun because when it just starts to go down, we jump up and it feels like you're jumping really high.
Do you ever get sick?
No, but some older ones get pretty fast sick.
Oh, you're pointing the finger at somebody. Who's that? You do, yeah, something?
Yeah. I do, but after 3 days, I'm fine.
3 days? Well, that doesn't sound like any fun.
No, that doesn't sound fun, but after 3 days, I love it.
The kids say they do get tired of living inside the cramped hull of a sailboat. They tell me there's only so many ways to cook a head of cabbage. But they do keep busy with their tutor, and they've got a violin, there's a guitar and a cello on board, and the family has been known to sing, with no one on earth around to hear as they sail the Pachamama across the globe. The Shuvo family last November on their boat in Boston Harbor. After we met, they sailed south past Rhode Island. They spent the winter in New England, and by April they were on the water again. They threaded the East River in New York City. They took a hard charge to the east, and early this month they reached the warmer waters of Bermuda. And as we speak right now, they are just a little dot in the Atlantic, halfway to Europe. You can follow their progress at hereandnow.org.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you everything you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste, and it's delivered right to your door. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying seasonally inspired recipes and exploring new flavors and cuisines. No commitment. Get the meals only when you want. Get your first 3 Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/here.
So, Peter, I once had a little dog I named Homie because I found him homeless outside the studios of that show that had Homie the Clown.
Yeah.
And you have Bisbee.
Yeah, yeah, a little chihuahua named after a quirky little mining town in Arizona.
Okay, there you have it. But do names matter when it's a wild animal? A lion named Cecil, sadly killed in Zimbabwe, a 60-something Laysan albatross named Wisdom, a jaguar named El Jefe, who's been videotaped roaming around in Arizona. Mm-hmm. They're superstars. Their social lives, their deaths, making headlines. Is it because of the names? Vicky Croak, who covers all things animal for us, is here. What does it mean, Vicky, when scientists give a wild animal a name?
Well, hey, Robin. Naming animals instead of identifying them with numbers has become increasingly accepted. People may remember that the famous primatologist Jane Goodall was criticized in the 1960s for naming the wild chimp she studied, among my favorites, Flo, David Greybeard, and Ollie. But you may also have noticed that Dr. Goodall's work has held up pretty well, despite that criticism. And since then, lots of new science has amplified our understanding of the thoughts and emotions of animals. And naming them is a way of recognizing that animals are individuals. Particularly when it comes to social animals, it's easy to see that certain individuals matter a lot and in different ways to their group. And I got to talk about the merits of naming wild animals with Paula Kahumbu. Speaking of superstars, she is a superstar Kenyan conservationist and ecologist. And I caught up with her at a wildlife conference, the Rethinking Animal Summit in New York City this month.
So I think we're kind of arrogant thinking that we shouldn't give elephants or lions or any other species names. But we know from science that every single elephant is individual. It has a personality and they're unique. Some elephants are playful. Some elephants are calm, like Tim. He's this phenomenal giant who is curious about people. And he'll walk up to your car and he'll watch you and he'll sniff you. He's not just doing it because he's bored or tired. He's really interested in who we are.
So Dr. Kahumbu is the head of a conservation group called Wildlife Direct. She says, without question, that naming of animals is a good way to share their stories with everybody, including local communities like the people who live around Amboseli National Park, where Tim lives.
I know for a fact that Kenyans are falling in love with elephants because they now know that there is this magnificent guy called Tim who is the stud and the heartthrob of all the girl elephants in Amboseli. And every Kenyan who comes to Amboseli, the first thing they ask at the gate is, where is Tim?
But Vicky, does that make them at all a target for poachers? I mean, if you know there's this elephant out there named Tim.
So Dr. Kahumbu believes the attention can actually make Tim safer. I mean, you can't be sure about that, but it was a group of women in the community around Amboseli who suggested designating Tim as an official national treasure. That's pending. But they're invested in many ways in helping to protect him, as Maasai Rangers from the Big Life Foundation. And Amboseli, famous for its elephants, has been doing well. That's also the thinking, by the way, here in the States for groups like Conservation Catalyst, who introduced us to the jaguar El Jefe. A while back, Tucson students gave him that name, and a few months ago, I talked about a different unnamed male jaguar in the state. He's now got a name given to him by the students at the Pascua Yaqui Reservation. They call him Yo'oko,
really?
And that's part of a longer name that translates in English to jaguar warrior.
I want that name. Well, you know, you also tell us some species like bottlenose dolphins have what are called signature whistles to identify themselves. It starts when they're babies, so maybe we should just listen to them.
They got
their own names. Vicky Croak, host of WBUR's The Wildlife Blog. Thanks, as always.
Thank you, guys.
Donald Trump kicks off his first trip abroad as president today, arriving first in Saudi Arabia, whose leaders plan an elaborate reception, in contrast with President Obama's last visit there when barely anyone greeted him at the airport. Trump will meet with the country's King Salman, as well as more than 50 leaders and representatives from the Muslim world. There will also be a country music concert featuring Toby Keith. Lise Doucette is chief international correspondent for the BBC. She's in Riyadh. Lise, what's it like there?
Robin, you go through the very hot streets of Riyadh and everywhere you look, you can't avoid it. These huge billboards with a picture of U.S. President Donald Trump and the Deputy Crown Prince, and under a slogan saying, "Together we will prevail." This is a celebration of a partnership, a friendship that the Saudis hope will turn the page from a strained relationship with President Obama. And to do this, they're not just rolling out a massive red royal carpet, they're rolling out the superlatives on the very glitzy website for what's being described as the Riyadh Summit. This is being described as the first of its kind in history.
Well, you mentioned President Obama earlier. The Saudis especially angry at him because of the deal with Iran. But you spoke with the Saudi foreign minister about this upcoming visit. Here's a little of what he said.
This is a very powerful message to the Islamic world that America and the West is not your enemy. This is a very powerful message to the West that Islam is not your enemy. This visit will change the discourse and the dialogue.
Well, this is so interesting, Lise Doucette, because it was President Trump and Citizen Trump who's one of those who conflated, you know, Muslims with extreme Islamists and who criticized Saudi Arabia for not paying its share and said the U.S. is losing a tremendous amount of money to them, accused Saudi Arabia of being behind the 9/11 attacks. So interesting. He's the one who said Islam hates us.
Well, and never mind that you still hear echoes of those kind of statements by the President Donald Trump, but Saudi leaders are very adamant that there is a difference between Donald Trump, the candidate, and Donald Trump, the president. Now, privately, one very senior official said to me they were worried a bit about the controversies now in Washington over the alleged mishandling of intelligence, whether that could overshadow this visit. But the official pointed out that since this visit to Saudi Arabia is taking place over the weekend, it was more likely to perhaps disrupt the conversation on the second leg of his visit, which will take place in Israel.
Yeah. Very quick, Trump is expected to give a speech on Islamic extremism, been billed by some analysts as a counterpoint to Barack Obama's famous A New Beginning speech in Cairo in 2009. He was reaching out to the Muslim world. Now President Trump is speaking about Islamic extremism. What missteps could he make here?
Well, one young Saudi put it, the elephant in Riyadh, the worry that President Trump could put a foot wrong. But I think his team is also aware of that. So he will be cautioned to step very carefully and to stick to the autocue, or at least to stick to the script. But this will be a very different speech from the one which had been widely hailed at the time across the Muslim world when President Obama began in Cairo. The way one of the foreign ministers from the Gulf put it to me was, he said, if President Obama was about change, in other words, a president who ended up siding with the protesters during the Arab Spring, he said that President Trump will be the man of stability.
Just, you know, the president's also bringing his wife, Melania. This is going to be there's going to be a lot on display here. You know, just your sense of the wow factor of this weekend.
A lot of glitter, a lot of pageantry. This is, of course, is a royal family, not just the rulers of Saudi Arabia. They have petrodollars to spend. But, of course, behind all that, when you bring along females, the question is, what are they going to wear? This is a kingdom where women wear these long abayas. They dress very modestly. A lot of Saudi women cover their heads. When the German Chancellor Angela Merkel came, she famously did not wear this abaya, the cloak. But in newspapers, they pixelated her hair and face. So you couldn't see all of the Chancellor. And the foreign minister was asked, press conference, whether there would be a dress code for Melania Trump. And he said, no, we don't write it all out. But I think there will be a lot of attention to see what will Melania wear and what will Ivanka wear.
Lise Doucet, Chief International Correspondent for the BBC. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And a big part of that trip will focus on a major arms deal between the two countries. For a closer look at that, we're joined now by Cole Bockenfeld. He's Deputy Director for Policy at the Project on Middle East Democracy. And Cole, this weapons sale could end up totaling more than $100 billion over 10 years. It's a huge amount of money. What's in it? What does Saudi Arabia get for $100 billion?
Well, it looks like this arms sale really runs the whole gamut. I mean, this is support to Saudi's army, its navy, its air force, sort of border security and missile defense. So they're really throwing everything into this sale. Now, I should say that, of course, a lot of these sales that we expect to be announced this weekend were actually negotiated over the past year or so under the Obama administration. Mm. But Trump's really looking to package them together for that big ticket announcement.
Right. The U.S. has been making these sales for years with Saudi Arabia. But President Obama actually delayed some of the sales just before he left office because his administration was worried about civilian casualties in Yemen, where Saudi Arabia has been fighting Iranian-backed Houthi rebels. Does the Trump administration not have the same concerns?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that is one of the more concerning pieces of this sale that we're worried about going forward. And really, it's emblematic of sort of the Trump administration's move more broadly to decouple and de-link human rights concerns and really how these weapons are used with the sale of weapons themselves.
So what does it mean for Yemen? Because I assume a lot of these weapons will be used there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what this means is it sends a clear signal to Saudi Arabia of unconditional U.S. support to their military operations in Yemen. At least with the Obama administration, it was a little bit of a mixed bag where they held back some missiles but continued providing some intelligence, continued provided aerial refueling and so on. But more clearly, it sends a signal that the U.S. believes that there is a military solution to this conflict. When for years, the U.S., the U.N., almost every actor involved has said pretty clearly, look, the only way this will end is a political settlement. And so, unfortunately, we're worried that the signal this would send would be for the Saudis to keep bombing Yemen, that they can somehow win this on the battlefield. But in reality, it'll be the Yemeni people that really suffer as this war continues to drag on.
Right. Is there any reason to believe that the weapons that the U.S. is selling to Saudi Arabia won't be used in attacks that cause major civilian casualties as they have in the past?
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, no. I don't think there's a lot of evidence. You know, the U.S. has been very clear over the past few years that they're very upset with some of the targets that the Saudis have hit, including schools, hospitals, funerals, and so on. And really, it's not an argument about whether they're using precise enough missiles and that's why they're missing and hitting these civilian targets. It's that the Saudis are selecting these targets themselves. And so I think it's fair to expect that they'll continue to do so.
If you dig into what's on this list of weapons, one of them is the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD. It's an anti-ballistic missile system. We just saw the U.S. help establish the same system in South Korea to protect against North Korea. Why do the Saudis want that?
Right. Well, I think it's for, you know, primarily for deterrence against Iran. And a lot of these arms sales, I should say, more broadly to Saudi Arabia and the Gulf are about deterring Iran, about arming up our allies in the event of a conflict with Iran. And so that's sort of the signal, I think, sent by them. But it's unclear if it actually has that impact or it just ratchets up the tensions in the region so that the Iranians also escalate their military capabilities.
Right. So what do other countries in the region think about the deal?
I mean, obviously, I think, you know, the Iranians are obviously unhappy to see that. You know, I think more broadly, you know, one of the things I should point out about this sale is that it's not necessarily so different from the Obama administration. The Obama administration sold Saudi Arabia about $115 billion worth of arms over the course of his two terms. And so, of course, this is a big number. It is a significant announcement, but it's really more of a continuation of that than anything. I think the mistake that President Trump and his administration could make with a sale is to believe that somehow these arms sales would buy goodwill or would somehow improve the relationship on their own. That's something we saw the Obama administration tried to do after the Iran deal to reassure its Gulf allies. And to be honest, it didn't really improve the relationship or get the U.S. anything more than we were getting before.
Hmm. Cole Bockenfeld is Deputy Director for Policy at the Project on Middle East Democracy. Cole, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And it's a cyclical thing. In Washington, D.C., with every new administration, comes a flood of young people who move to the district to work in and around that administration. They transform neighborhoods, bars, and the dating scene. So, question, do bipartisan romances still blossom in the nation's capital as the country becomes much more polarized? Michaela Lefrak from Here Now contributor WAMU went to find out.
If you're looking for someone who typifies the D.C. dating scene, look no further than Brenna Duncan.
You know, I work pretty long hours and have a commute and a puppy who takes up a lot of my time. It's hard to meet people, you know.
Duncan's 29 and a lawyer. And like many people in D.C., she's a liberal and hates Donald Trump. I met her at a coffee shop where she told me she tends to meet guys on dating apps. But late last year, she found herself in the midst of a string of bad dates. Then she was swiping through profiles one night when she found Brian. She sent him a message and he asked her to dinner at a nice Italian restaurant.
And it was a great first date. I really liked how old-fashioned he was in a lot of ways, and I liked that he did dinner on the, like, I felt like that took a big risk, and it paid off, though. It paid off.
They talked for 2 hours. Politics never came up because Brenna said she didn't feel like she needed to ask. She just assumed he didn't vote for Donald Trump. Then came date number 2.
And I remember when he said, I voted for Trump, I just put down my silverware. I said, I really liked you, past tense. And this was toward the end of it, really what had so far been a great dinner.
She almost got up and left, but Brian convinced her to stay. He paid for the meal, and outside, she told him it was over.
I just, like, couldn't have a rational conversation at that point, because I was like, darn it, like, this is the first really good person I've met recently. And, he just killed it for me.
Duncan has a lot of company. Since the election, politics have become more of a deal breaker for singles, according to data from a number of popular dating sites. Take the dating app The League. It has 20,000 users in D.C., and 2/3 of them say it's become more important in the past year to find a partner who shares their political views. One side in particular has become more unwilling to date outside their lane, liberals. On multiple dating sites, liberals report being significantly less interested in dating conservatives than vice versa.
I mean, I wouldn't date a Trump supporter.
Joanna Wendell is one of them. She's 26 and a freelance writer.
When somebody has beliefs that you think are just morally wrong, it feels like a personal attack on you. Like, if you don't think this way, then I don't know if I could be with you.
Some sites make it easy to learn about a match's politics with questionnaires and detailed profiles. On others, users only have photos or a one-sentence profile to signal if they're with her or if they're making America great again. Many DC singles say you can learn a lot from a profile picture. Wendell says seeing a guy's photo from the Women's March is a good sign for her. She finds herself analyzing photos for clues.
If he's like out fishing and holding a giant fish, I'm like, which is so, I know it's silly, but it's like, I don't know, I guess we're all just really, really sensitive to that stuff these days.
So DC Singles might be getting better about finding people who share their political values. But Jamie Bernstein with the matchmaking company 3-Day Rule says her liberal clientele could benefit from changing their attitude about people who have moved to town to work for the Trump administration.
People who supported Clinton are really more adamant about not meeting a Trump supporter. You know, there are new people that have come in that have filled some of these different positions, and so I think that should be looked upon as a positive.
27-year-old Blaine Toops has noticed the same thing. He's a conservative, but he didn't vote for Trump. He uses online dating apps and says he mostly ends up going out with liberals, which is fine by him. But on one recent date, when he brought up his old job working for a Republican politician in Virginia,
it was revealed that I'm not the most progressive person in the world. And you could just kind of see her shoulders slump a little bit that, you know, it was like I had disappointed her.
There are still many more liberals in D.C. Half of D.C.'s OKCupid members identify as liberal, and only 5% say they're conservative. But those ratios have already started to change. In the past few months, the number of conservative OKCupid users in D.C. has doubled. And then there's Brenna Duncan's story. Back at the coffee shop, she tells me her relationship with Brian didn't actually end after that disastrous second date. She called him the next day and told him she wanted to see him again. They've been dating now for more than 4 months. Her friends even have a nickname for him.
Everyone calls him the Trump guy or the Trump voter.
Duncan says she's not sure if she can see herself ending up with a staunch conservative in the long term. But for now, she likes the chance to have discussions about Trump's policies with someone she likes and trusts. She says her liberal friends are watching the relationship closely.
They're all kind of curious to see how this turns out because, I mean, we just have to face the reality that more and more people in D.C. are people who support Trump.
And if arguing about politics on a date still doesn't sound all that romantic to you, matchmaker Jamie Bernstein says a passionate political debate can bring out passion in other, more intimate parts of a relationship. For Here and Now, I'm Michaela Lefrak in Washington.
Hey, if Mika and Joe could do it. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.